Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, October 30th, welcome, welcome, welcome on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. No preamble today, folks. We're diving straight into the show. Next Tuesday, voters will select Philadelphia's next district attorney. Today, we'll have separate conversations with both major candidates.
First up is Patrick Dugan, a self-described independent Democrat. Dugan is running in this general election as a Republican, and this comes 6 months after he lost the Democratic primary. Before jumping into this unusual race, Dugan was a longtime municipal court judge here in Philadelphia. He was born and raised in this city and served multiple stints in the armed forces. Patrick Dugan, welcome to Studio 2.
Cherry, Avi, thanks for having me. Appreciate you having me here.
And we appreciate our audience being here as well. We invite you to join today's conversations. What issue does the next Philly DA need to tackle first? What's motivating your vote next Tuesday? If you have questions for the candidates, you can send those in as well. 888-477-9499 is the number. The email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
So, Patrick Dugan, thank you so much for being here. And we're going to give you time to lay out your vision. But before we do that, we wanted to start with a big question that has come up over and over again. And that is about your party affiliation. You are a Democrat running as a Republican in this race for DA. Got to ask you, why did you decide to accept the GOP nomination after you said you wouldn't? And I want you to be specific and tell us, what changed your mind?
What changed my mind was the city of Philadelphia changed my mind. So yes, I lost in the Democratic primary in May. Now, the Republicans wrote me in. 7,000 people came out and wrote me in. Now, we know it's a tedious operation to go in and write somebody in behind the curtain. So 7,000 people came out and did that. So I became, in effect, the Republican nominee in the general election. Now, yes, I am a Democrat my whole life. So now I'm the Republican nominee. I wasn't taking it until for the last couple months prior to me jumping back in. People were coming up to me all everywhere I went, were calling me, you got to run, because otherwise Larry Krasner would be unopposed. And I don't think that that should occur. I am not embracing the Democrat or the Republican political party. I am running as a Philadelphian. Besides having 53,000 Democrats who voted for me, 7,000 Republicans who wrote me in, I had the Forward Party came out and endorsed me, an independent political organization. Their motto is not left, not right, but move forward. Mm-hmm. I'm not running as a Democrat or a Republican. I'm running for all of Philadelphia. If they could put a P behind my name, I would prefer that.
Of course, for some voters, this is going to call into question your integrity, because you said at one point, or at least your campaign manager told the Inquirer, you would not accept this Republican nomination. Bob Brady, longtime head of the Philadelphia Democratic Party, also in the Inquirer, had some very choice words for you. Quote, he's got zero integrity, zero. How do you answer folks who are just questioning your sincerity given that particular flip-flop?
A man, a human being, has the right to change his mind. And I think me getting pop shots at me, that doesn't bother me. It truly doesn't. I'm running because of the ineffectiveness, the ineptness, and the people, the victims that are not being heard in the criminal justice system. And for Bob Brady to come out and kill me with that quote about my integrity, yeah, that hurt deeply. Do you know why? Because I question the integrity of all the Democratic elected officials in the city of Philadelphia, including Bob Brady, who have said to me, have been saying to me since I stepped off the bench in December, that you got to beat this guy. None of them have the guts to come out and say it publicly.
So what they say behind closed doors, you say, does not match up with their rhetoric in the public.
Well put.
Well, let me ask you, though, building off of that, we will get to all this policy stuff in a second, but I have to imagine, when you were hearing those things behind closed doors and when you were making this decision, you're having conversations with people. And I just have to imagine at some point you were persuaded that you would have real material support in this race, money backing. And yet the fundraising just hasn't been there. Did people pull a flip flop on you? Did they promise you things they have not delivered on? Because I would just, if that were to occur and I was in your position, I would be quite frustrated given the leap of faith you've taken here.
Again, we're telepathic right now. Absolutely am frustrated that part of my decision making is to go ahead and run as the Republican nominee. I was believing that I was going to get a lot more financial support.
From who
specifically? Were promises made?
They made it feel like I was going to get a lot of money, some resources from folks. Now, I can tell you that hasn't materialized, but what has materialized is I have an army of volunteers. I have zero paid staff. We've raised only $40,000. And on that small budget, we are moving mountains. We are banging on doors. We are hanging door hangers. We are getting people out to vote. And that's what has to happen. Only 16% of registered voters voted in the primary. That's a disgrace. Mm-hmm. Folks, you have to come out and vote. Whether you're voting for me or Larry Krasner, but do what democracy is. You have a say. You have to come out and vote. So we're doing a grassroots effort right now. Yeah, I'm disappointed. I was hoping that some people would throw a bunch of money in.
The union specifically?
Excuse me?
The union specifically who backed you in the primary or others? Oh,
so the unions? So yes, Ryan Boyer came out and said the building trades are no longer with me.
Yep. Mm.
Well, he misspoke. Ryan Boyer's the head of the building trades. Almost every other union in the building trades are still with me. Local 98, the Teamsters, the sprinkler fitters, the steam fitters, transportation workers, Local 22, the EMTs. So I have tremendous support from the unions. Now, because of the campaign finance laws in the city of Philadelphia, you can only give so much money.
They've maxed out their contributions.
They have maxed out. So unfortunately, they cannot give me any money. What they can do is they can put people out on the street. They can put people door knocking for me. And they've been doing that. So this is the army of, I'm calling them volunteers. They're part of it.
And so we're going to zoom out now because we know you're running against Larry Krasner, but you also are running with your own vision for criminal justice if elected the top prosecutor in the city. So we want to give you a couple of minutes and just talk to, you know, Philadelphia voters. Tell them about who you are if they don't know you and what your vision would be if elected.
So as you said in the introduction, I'm a lifelong Philadelphian. Was born in Fairmount. My mom thought she was moving on up. We moved to Frankfort. Single mother with five kids. I went to St. Joe's Prep on a merit need scholarship. Basically, we were poor, so I got this great scholarship to go to the prep. Wound up joining the Army. Jumped out of airplanes. 5 years overseas. So I served my nation, raised my hand. I believe in that oath. And I was blessed enough to become a municipal court judge here in the city of Philadelphia. Greatest job in the world. Absolutely loved doing it for 17 years. And I led national acclaimed program in Veterans Court. So I started Veterans Court in the city of Philadelphia. Holistic, restorative, rehabilitative type justice. Less than 10% recidivism rate. So those guys didn't come back to jail. They didn't come back to court. I would go into Graterford Prison with a van full of young defendants from my courtroom. We would drive up to Graterford Prison, go behind the cells and talk to lifers in a table like we're sitting at here today, so that the lifers could talk to the newly minted veteran defendants so they would try to persuade them, don't do what I did so you're not my cellmate. This is what some of the stuff that I've done. I started this. Pat Dugan, the Republican nominee, started the eviction diversion program. I was the president judge who started that program. 46,000 people avoided eviction. $300 million were paid to the landlord. So when people are trying to paint me as he's going to be tough on crime, no, I'm going to be smart on crime. I believe in diversion and restorative rehabilitative justice, but I also believe there has to be accountability for the people who are running around carjacking people, shooting up soccer fields. So I can walk and chew gum at the same time. People breaking the law, they have to be held accountable with some smartness and empathy. But if they're going to be violent about it, they need to pay the price.
What specifically isn't the DA doing right now that you would do?
The DA likes to go around and say, I'm the most progressive DA in the country. I call them out on that. Hogwash. Mm-hmm. I want him to point to one program that he's actually doing. He's got some emerging adult program that nobody in the system understands it. If you bring the person who's running that program in here and ask, double down on what it is you do, show me it, they could never show it to the courts. This is something outside the court system. All our diversion programs, Larry Krasner, now I was the president judge for 5 years. So I was in internal meetings with all leadership, including Larry. These diversion programs that, again, drug treatment court, Philadelphia had one of the first most productive drug treatment courts in the country. We led the nation. Larry Krasner obstructs these. He truly does. You would think the most progressive.
You're saying he's against diversion?
I am saying that. And you don't have to ask me.
And when you say obstruct, what does that mean?
He doesn't allow them to run smoothly like they used to. He doesn't cooperate. He blocks them. He doesn't want people to be arrested. He doesn't want them to be put in that program. Example, the biggest example I can give you is this wellness court in Kensington. If you read between the lines and talk to Commissioner Bethel and Mayor Parker, the reason why that court is not working, they do it on Wednesday and it's a couple cases. If you walk through Kensington, there should be 100 cases a day. It's not happening. And the only reason it's not happening is because Larry Krasner is not cooperating with the police, the courts, Mayor Parker.
Why would he do that? Why would he do that, Pat Dugan? Why would he obstruct these programs, these diversionary programs that you say are intended to help people?
That's a heck of a good question. I wish I knew that answer. The only thing that I can come up with is that while he says he's progressive, I think I would actually use the word anarchist. And I truly mean that.
And I want to get specific with you because I know you have said that the DA's office has gone too far towards leniency. And I want to get specific because, you know, Krasner has sort of promoted some progressive policies. You say he's not a progressive, but ending cash bail for most nonviolent offenses has been something he's talked about. Expanded diversion, you've commented about that. Also, he created the Conviction Integrity Unit to overturn wrongful convictions and declining to prosecute low-level crimes like simple marijuana possession, prostitution, and things like that. So tell me, go specific about some of these policies that I mentioned. Which ones do you think actually help or cause the public to be less safe? Give us your take on each of these. Which ones you would keep or get rid of if you were elected?
So the no cash bail on low-level cases that where you're sign on bond and released on your own recognizance, the courts have been doing that for years anyway. So the numbers were coming down to people who were going to jail for these low-level crimes. Our courts, we started programs to address those bails. So if somebody got a bail on a low-level case, we would hurry up and review that case within a couple days and make sure they got out. So I'm all on board for that. Small amount of marijuana. Somebody's marijuana is like a glass of wine or a beer for another person. The only thing I say about marijuana is please don't do it near my window because I really don't want to get high. All these people are, when you're in the traffic now, you're getting high. But that's the one issue I have with that. The Conviction Integrity Unit, I have to correct you on one thing. Seth Williams actually started that
but
program.
It wasn't effective. I covered it. It wasn't very as effective as the Krasner CIU.
So the only question I have is the word integrity, right? Mm. There have been some call outs recently about Larry's office with the integrity part of the Conviction Integrity Unit. We're talking about overturning murders, right? Mm-hmm. Convicted murders. Mm-hmm. A murderer who's in jail, somebody who's been convicted of a crime, we need to move mountains to get them out. Mm-hmm. I will continue to do that, but I will bring the word, I will put the word integrity back in that office. So one judge fined Larry Krasner's office $120,000 for lying on a case. Basically, the underlying case was about a conviction being overturned. A federal judge, Judge Goldberg, chastised Larry's office for lying about a case where they were trying to take it from a death penalty to life imprisonment. And Krasner's office went in front of that federal judge and said that we had spoken to the victims. And there was a double murder years ago. An infant survived it. Krasner's office didn't speak to that now 30-some-year-old woman about what she thought the position of the DA's office would be. That judge was mad, basically called him out as a liar. Justice Weck from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said all Larry does on these exoneration cases.
And we will ask him about some of these and give him an opportunity to respond. But you're saying that you would, if you were elected, that you would keep the CIU, you would just be a little, you would do things differently.
Yeah, I would make sure that there's due diligence, that you actually review all the files, to go back and talk to all these old prosecutors and homicide cops. That's what I would want to do. I would also make sure that I have the chief of the Conviction Integrity Unit, a person who will never come into court and say, I'm going to plead the fifth, like Patricia Cummings. Her lawyers told Judge Coyle she is not coming to court to talk about that case about trying to overturn the conviction of a murderer. She told the lawyers, and the lawyers said it to the court, if she comes, she's got to plead the Fifth Amendment.
I'm trying to sort of thread all this together, because these are all sort of individual cases, right? And you're accusing people in the DA office of not being prepared or not being truthful. And I'm trying to understand the common theme. You believe these people are specifically not prepared or not well-trained because the district attorney wants there to be anarchy in the city of Philadelphia. That was sort of your claim earlier. And
I'll double down on that.
Okay. So that is what you're saying. And I guess for people living in the Philadelphia, then looking at, you know, year-to-date homicides, 190.
Thank God. I wish it was zero.
Yeah, but it's lower than it's been since at least 2007, maybe further back. I don't know how far back the YTD sets to go. If this is indeed sort of an anarchist plot, I mean, it's hard to explain then the recent drop in crime. Obviously, it went up in the early years of Krasner's tenure. We acknowledge that.
The early years, about 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, but since it's gone straight down. Sure. And he's still the same guy with, you would say, the same motivations, right?
Yes.
So how do you explain any of that?
So the numbers before Larry Krasner came in office, we had 277 1 year. Now, I'm saying we're going back to pre-Krasner numbers, because during his tenure, it was brutal. And I understand the numbers are going down now. What's different right now? What's different is Commissioner Bethel and Mayor Parker.
You see, he has no
so
role
he had
in
all
that.
The, are you saying that he was the blame from before but doesn't get any of the credit now?
So what I'm saying is, if he's going to jump up and down and take credit for in year 8 that it's going down, does he get credit for the 7 years of the numbers being through the roof? So if we look at the big picture, close to 3,200 murders in the city of Philadelphia, right? So he doesn't get credit for all those murders. I'm saying that he has to take responsibility for them as well. The numbers are going down, but I believe that it has a lot to do with the programs, the foresight that the director of public safety is doing, that the mayor created, what Mayor Parker came in and said, we're actually going to go after people committing crimes. And Commissioner Bethel's forward thinking on how to police community policing, I think that's had a big effect in it.
I do want to ask also about the prison population, because I anticipate that when the DA comes on this program momentarily, he will say that crime is down and fewer people are in prison. So when in January 2018, when he started, the numbers were already going down before he got in. But
yes,
there were
part of that.
There were 6,300 people in Philadelphia prisons. The latest numbers I saw, 3,500. That's a pretty big drop. So he would say people are safer and freer. And I'm curious, I'm anticipating he'll say that, how you respond to that.
Safer and freer. How about if we ask that 7-year-old girl that was shot in Fairhill the other day, thankfully just in the arm. Fairhill, according to real estate websites, is 380% more dangerous than the average neighborhood in the country. My grandson was practicing soccer at 17th and Allegheny a couple nights ago, and some clown standing on a corner decided to shoot up a car. Bullets whizzed over my grandson's head, him and 40 other kids practicing. 37 bullets whizzed over their head. This stuff is out there every day, and all you have to do is ask people who live in Strawberry Mansion, Fairhill, Port Richmond. Port Richmond is 206% more dangerous than the average neighborhood in America.
And all of that is truly is tragic, but I think what a lot of people say is that has always been the case, and what Krasner has been able to do is, you know, at least recently reduce crime while keeping people out of prison. And we know that there are a lot of downsides to being in prison and being incarcerated, both for the person and their family.
So ask all those people who had to shut down their stores because of the retail theft epidemic that went on under his unilateral policy of anything under $500 is now a ticketable offense. Ask the more than 20,000 people who've been victims of breaking in their cars or car thefts. Look at those statistics that are actually on his site. And then when you go down all the bottom, there's been like 8 people held responsible.
Yeah.
So those numbers, he's got more statisticians in his office than he does people who are out there trying to help people.
And I want to shift the gears a bit because I want to talk about the Kaeda Scott case as well. And, you know, you've been talking about this recently, and some would say you politicized this case, and you went on Fox News and called the DA a co-conspirator in her killing, saying that the DA's office enabled the accused Keon King. I want you to sort of lay out your argument and then explain why you took it that far.
I took it that far because I believe it. Now, I resigned as a judge because I saw this happening on the bench for the last, well, I was up for 7 years that Krasner was the DA. I saw victims not being heard, not having their day in court. Mm-hmm. Kaeda Scott, the ultimate person responsible for her murder is Keon King, no doubt about it. But if you're the DA, you need to hold Keon King responsible when he's committed violent crimes against other women. He had the opportunity earlier this year. And in that case, there was video evidence that was not presented to the court. Now, the victim did not show up to court. So the Commonwealth, Krasner's office, withdrew those charges. Instead of putting up the video evidence, he didn't do it. In his press conference, he said it was complicated, whatever. It's not complicated. It's prosecution 101, and that goes to the lack of training. And the DAs who leave that office will tell you the training is bizarre, has nothing to do with being a prosecutor. Also, during this previous case, before Kaeda Scott, there was another arrest warrant that was put out on Mr. Keon King. And while that first case was going on where the victim wasn't showing up, that DA should have said to the judge, Keon King has a new arrest warrant out for him. We need to take him into custody, Your Honor, and tell the sheriffs, tell the police. They didn't do it. Previous district attorney's office, that was standard policy.
And so if you were to be elected, how would you close the gap? What would you specifically do to change?
I'm going to train the district attorneys. I'm going to give them mentors. I'm going to give them supervision. That has almost stopped in the DA's office. They used to, the supervisors and the mentors would lurk around for those new DAs. I will also, when they come back from their day in court, you do an after action report. Hey, I had 20 cases today. We withdrew 15. Why? Let's look at what we could have done better. That doesn't happen anymore, and it used to happen.
And I got to ask you, because you did talk about this Kaeda Scott case, have you reached out to the family? And what did they say to you, if anything?
No, I have tried to reach out to the family, and I hate the fact that we're actually talking about Kaeda Scott like this, but Kaeda Scott is the reason why I resigned. Now, I know I resigned in December to run, but I saw other victims this happening too. This was not a case that fell through the cracks. A previous victim by the name of Gladys Coriano, her son testified that, because they said Gladys Coriano's case, which was a similar domestic, her ex-husband, he testified this wasn't a crack in the system. He said it was a trap door created by Larry Krasner, that his policies are the cause of these victims being victimized again and then losing their lives. It should have been stopped years ago. I understand mistakes. It's a big city. There's violence. But as the prosecutor, your number one job should not be coddling criminals. It should be protecting our victims and upholding the rule of law.
One consistent criticism is around this training of new attorneys, and I guess attorneys already in the office. And you said that you're going to go back to things that they did before. Now, of course, this is Krasner's core message. The way things were done before was not adequate. It was people sort of going for the prosecutorial jugular just because, to get their own stats up, and that sort of the old way of training prosecutors was itself broken. So when you say you want to reinstate some things from the past, I guess I want you to be specific and also address, are there things that could be changed in the way prosecutors were trained in the past?
And we have about a minute. So.
Okay, yeah. There's a lot of things that we could do. We could walk and chew gum at the same time. You heard my background. I want the restorative, rehabilitative type justice. My DAs are going to be trained to be able to do that, to recommend that. I don't want the stats. I don't want the jugular. I don't want to convict every single person in that come in front of the courts. But I do want to hold those who are being violent. I want to hold them responsible. And it does start with training. We're not going back 30 years. We're not going to be doing that. We could be smart and do this in the proper way. Again, those really bad guys, they need to be put away. People who had a bad day, we need to help them. And that's what I did for 17 years on the bench. That's who I am as a man.
Judge Patrick Dugan, running for Philadelphia District Attorney. We wish you luck next week at the polls.
Thank you. No luck. Everybody's got to come out to vote, no matter who you're voting for.
Yeah. Coming up next, we'll hear from incumbent District Attorney Larry Krasner. Stick with us. You don't want to miss it. This is Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Larry Krasner has been Philadelphia's district attorney since 2018. It has been a headline-grabbing tenure, spurred by his promises to shake up the office and reimagine the role of prosecutors.
Krasner is now seeking a third term. Prior to this job, he was a civil rights attorney here in Philadelphia. In May, he won the Democratic primary over our prior guest, Patrick Dugan. They now face off again in the general election. Larry Krasner, welcome back to Studio 2.
Well, thank you for having me. It's getting kind of spiffy around here.
We try.
Thanks for being in studio. And for our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, our question of the day: what issue does the next Philly DA need to tackle first? What's motivating your vote next Tuesday? You can email studio2 at whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, share the video, but also drop your comments in the chat. And so, Larry, I know we have limited time with you. And so before we give you a chance to sort of lay out your vision for a third term, we're going to start with the issue that's on everybody's mind. And that's the issue with the Kata Scott case. And Mr. Krasner, Keon King had two prior domestic violence cases, one from December of 2024, another from January of this year, that involved serious charges against a different woman, in connection with a different woman. Both were dismissed. And King was free at the time of Kata Scott's murder. You said your office could have done better. I want you to get specific. Where exactly do you think your office and the system broke down? And what specific changes would you make in a third term to make sure that that doesn't happen again?
Well, you know, simply put, a lot of things were actually done right in this case in terms of my office. There was a high level of prep. There were subpoenas going out to the addresses we had. There were phone calls being made. There was every effort to bring in an eyewitness and also to bring in the victim. And considerable work had been done to make those people safe as well. But there were two different listings where the witnesses did not appear. Mm-hmm. And what I would characterize as being something we could do better, yeah, is that the attorney who had it may have had the opportunity to put on the case without any witnesses. It's hard to do. But there was a patchwork of pieces of video from different places and times that it is possible could have been used to hold that case over for trial. We've owned that. You know, I've been clear that, yeah, the buck stops with me in reference to that. But I will also say, let us not get this twisted. This defendant was out of custody. Even if he had been held over at a preliminary hearing, which is where this was, even if he had been found to be worthy of facing trial on these charges, he would have been on the street. And what he did on the street. There are other things, and as I've said over and over, and I'll say again, I'm not here to put names in it and throw people under the bus. That's useless. That's what government does when politicians are doing the wrong thing. But there are systemic things that could have been done and that need to be done and that we are working on that will require partnership with other entities, things like information sharing that would make readily available across law enforcement the existence of open warrants against certain people. It's not the DA's job to make arrests on those warrants, but we would love to be in a position to back up other law enforcement entities whose job it is to make arrests on those warrants. that capacity hasn't been there. And we're dealing with legacy systems, data systems that are 20 years old that really should have been upgraded a long time ago to share information. There's some other things systemically that we can do, and I'm hoping to work with others to do that.
Yeah. Your opponent says that this comes down to prosecutorial training, that the decision to not proceed with the case based on the video evidence available is indicative of an attorney or a group of attorneys that simply don't know the ins and outs of the law in prosecuting. How do you respond to that claim?
Well, you know, I don't necessarily want to go there, but my opponent has never tried a felony case, any felony case ever. Not as a judge, not as a defense lawyer, not as a prosecutor, okay? So if I'm going to have people train my prosecutors to handle serious cases, frankly, it wouldn't be him. It would be the people who we have in the office. This office, without question, is the most capable DA's office I've seen in my whole career. The people we have hired are extraordinary. They don't always get everything right because nobody does. That's just how it is. But they're extraordinary. The training is much longer. The trainers are much better, and we don't cheat, and we don't lie.
How is the training different? How did you change the training for prosecutors in your office? And of course, you've also pursued hiring different types of people, and you've been very open about that. You've been looking for people all over the country to come into the office. Some people criticize you for that. How is the hiring different, and how is the training different?
Well, let's start with the basics. We made a decision to start training future attorneys right after Labor Day. They used to arrive much later and start the training later, so our training is longer. We made a decision to do full training before they pass the bar. We made a decision to have people who are permanent trainers on staff. That's essentially what they do. They go through first jury trials, first shooting trials, first rape trials with attorneys who've never done those things before. So we have taken a very robust approach to it. We have a lot of in-office training. We actually host continuing legal education, not only for our attorneys, but also for other defense attorneys and other attorneys who are required to get their credits in order to continue to practice law. So we have been very, very serious about it, and it does start with recruiting. I can tell you that we go all over the country. We frequently find Philadelphians in Chicago, Philadelphians at UCLA in Los Angeles, and we find other talented people from all over the country. We get very high level of talent. We get really idealistic people, people with an intact moral compass. They do not represent a monoculture of people who only grew up in a few grade schools, junior high schools in Philadelphia, and then get to reunite their monoculture when they're in the DA's office. And so it is a much more talented and much more diverse office than ever. That's not to take away from some of the great people who were there, because there were some great people there. Most of them are still in my office. They never left. But it is just a fair representation of what used to be in Philly and what is in most traditional prosecutors' offices, a monoculture.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about cash bail because, you know, cash bail reform has been, you know, an issue that has made Philadelphia and other cities with progressive prosecutors like yourself a target for the Trump administration and right-wing activists. And so I want you to sort of talk about cash bail reform, what it actually means, and then if Philadelphia had fully ended cash bail, how that would have impacted the case, the Kata Scott case, and specifically Keon King.
Well, I'm happy you raised that. So cash bail is the law in Pennsylvania, and it is what is used in most of the country. It's also a bad system. It basically makes the decision about whether someone should be out of custody before their trial about what they can afford, okay? There is a different system. It's a no cash bail system in which people who are really dangerous are held in custody no matter how rich they are. I repeat, held in custody no matter how rich they are before trial. And people who are broke and are charged with minor offenses are going to get out, even if they're too broke to pay 10 cents in bail. This has been used in D.C. for 35 years. It's been used now in Kentucky, Illinois, New Jersey, various other places. It is the modern trend. And the way it would have affected the Kata Scott case is that based upon the allegations, we would have sought, and I believe we would have achieved, Keon King being held in custody. Instead, what happened, and there would have been no amount of bail he could pay to get out. Instead, what happened was we asked for basically $1 million bail, and the bail commissioner approved $200,000. That may sound like a lot, but understand that really boils down to either you pay $20,000 yourself and you get it back later, so it's 10%, or you pay a bail bondsman a third of the $20,000, a third of that bail. So that would have been $6,667, get you out of custody on this serious case. You can't kill somebody if you're in custody, okay? I mean, maybe in jail you can, but you certainly couldn't have killed this young woman if you're in custody. So it is, I don't say this to throw that bail commissioner under the bus, but we've had a very long experience of trying to shift our system, because the law is what it is, so that judges are either applying high bail, which is the best we can do to simulate no cash bail, $1 million or more. They're applying high bail to really dangerous cases, but we're not going to stick broke people in jail for a couple bucks when a person with a job would be able to pay that couple of bucks. And this, I think, is a glaring example of why cash bail is dangerous, why it's foolish. You know, we even came with a second case related to some of the activity around the murder. We came with a second case, went in for bail again when everybody was paying attention to this case, asked for millions of dollars, had a judge do the same thing, apply the same bail one more time, you know, and we had reason to believe that this defendant and the family were in a position of getting together a way to pay it. I mean, like, how long does this have to go on? Can't we just have a system where if you're really dangerous, rich or not, you're going to be held? And if you're not really dangerous, you're not going to be held just because you're broke.
Yeah. One thing that your opponent says is that the training, or he would say under training of your staff, that the way you set bail, all of it is really designed to undermine the prosecutor's role in the criminal justice system. And that ultimately what you want is just less prosecution. And you're finding sort of end run ways to do that. How do you, and his rash, and I asked him why you would do that, and he said because you're essentially an anarchist. I used that phrase and he agreed. So I want you to respond to that criticism, that you, that what you are doing sort of in sum is designed to undermine the prosecutor's role writ large in the city of Philadelphia.
Well, if by the prosecutor's role he means charge as many people as possible with stuff and make us less safe, then maybe that's what he's talking about. But the fact is that what we have been doing with data, with research, with careful analysis of what's going on, is we have been trying to guide the city in the direction of having the lowest number of homicides in over 50 years, which we will have this year. That's what's happening, while simultaneously having the lowest number of people in custody in Philly in my whole career.
Now, he says that's all because of Mayor Parker and Commissioner Bethel. We asked if you deserved any credit for that, and he denied that. So I'm just curious.
I mean, that's an unsurprising answer from him. The data supports none of it. We're not dealing with a data guy. We're dealing with a guy who repeats Donald Trump's talking points. Pat Duggan is the branch office of the Trump campaign in Philly. His talking points are Trump's. They are fundamentally untruthful. He is not speaking from a position of actual knowledge. This is a man who is nearly my age and has never tried a felony case. As a judge, a defense lawyer, or a prosecutor, please tell me in what world that qualifies him to actually have these opinions or say these things when they run completely contrary to all the evidence.
I wanted to, well, one of the things that Duggan has done is run a diversion court with the veterans court. And so he critiqued the wellness court specifically, saying that your office was obstructing people going through this court. We want to give you a chance to talk about the wellness court and respond to what he said about the DA's office obstructing.
Well, I would ask if he gave any more specifics, but I know he didn't, because none of that relates to reality. The wellness court is not an invention of the Philadelphia DA's office. It is an invention of this administration that has had a rocky start. It's a work in progress. It's one where the truth is that it would have been better to include all the law enforcement partners early. And if that had happened, I think we'd be having more success. Mm-hmm. But we continue to meet about it. We continue to participate in it. It continues to be led by Adam Gear, by the mayor's office, and by others. And to date, it has not been successful as we would all hope. I do think that there's a core there that is good and has value. There's just more details that have to be worked out. We all want the same thing for Kensington. We all want the same thing for people who are suffering from addiction, and that is for them to heal. It's for them to be cured. It's for them not to die of fatal overdoses. It's for that neighborhood not to be burdened with the consequences of an out-of-control supply of opioids. We all want that. But Pat Dugan, as usual, has nothing to do with that, and he's just not being honest.
Whether it's Wellness Court, Veterans Court, Dawn Court, I think he has consistently criticized your take on diversion in general, just as a tactic. This is a statistic from Philadelphia Magazine. A percentage of cases diverted dropped from 13% under Seth Williams to 3.5% the past 4 years. What is your take on diversion as a tactic, as a legal tactic, as a way to address crime, but also get help for people who might need it? And are you committed to diversion?
We are far more committed to diversion than our predecessors. I hear your statistic, but understand what we're talking about. The police department has wisely come up with two separate diversion programs of its own, of their own. These are cases that never come into the system anymore.
So you're saying there's no need to divert them because they're catching them before the stage in which they would be diverted?
I'm saying there's no need to divert the cases that never get in the system.
Right.
I think it's good that the police set up PAD, which is police assisted diversion, where they stop people on the street and before they cuff them, they give them an opportunity at diversion. But that takes a ton of cases out of the system, mm-hmm. which is okay with me because I'm about people being safe and people being free. I'm not about racking up numbers for putting more people through the courts. Kevin Bethel, Commissioner Bethel, whom I like very much, has also come up with a diversionary program for juveniles. That's great. That never existed before. It's a diversionary program before arrest. Now, we have much more robust, much bigger, much broader diversionary programs in general, but the flow of cases that are appropriate to go into them has reduced. So this is just one more example of how, you know, my repeat opponent, let me put it that way, just keeps coming with upside down, you know, versions of the truth rather than the truth.
Well, you might respond in a similar way to my next question, which is about the Conviction Integrity Unit. And Dugan, you know, had all sorts of things to say about that and specifically called out what he called the lack of integrity on this unit. Could you talk about what this unit has done and just sort of respond to his claims that there have been judges that have called out some of your prosecutors through the execution of some of these wrongful conviction cases?
Sure. So, you know, I hate to keep coming back to it, but exonerations are almost all about homicides, nearly all about homicides. We're talking about a judge who has never done a felony, okay? Never done a car theft trial. Never touched a homicide as a trial. Yes, he's done preliminary hearings. Those aren't trials, okay? So it, once again, you know, it's a little bit like talking to midgets about basketball. I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous conversation. But as long as we are talking, we have had tremendous success in finding innocent people in jail and getting them out. And when we do that, it is always with the approval of the court, whether that is the ultimate decisions with the court, whether that's in federal court or whether it's in state court. There have been a few occasions when a few judges disagreed with us. That's fine. They should. The judiciary should be independent. We don't all assess credibility of a particular witness quite the same way. We don't all necessarily agree. So I don't really have a problem with that. I mean, you know, we can talk about Ohtani and what a great hitter he is. Well, he doesn't actually have a batting average of 1,000. He has a very, very high batting average. He's one of the greatest players of all time. We don't have to have a batting average of 1,000. If our batting average is 900, and I think ours is actually higher than that when it comes to the exonerations that we support, I think we're doing pretty well.
Why a third term? I mean, there. Look, obviously you stand by your record, but I'm curious, you have a decision here. You could say, I would like to pursue a different office for myself. You could say, I would like to pass the torch to the next generation. What have you not done that you feel like you need a third term to do?
Well, it's a great question. Number one, I love the job. I assume that's okay to love a job and want to keep doing it. There's an awful lot of Philadelphians who drive buses and, you know, coach football and do all kinds of things, and they just keep doing it because they love it. I love it. I mean, I am that rare politician who never really wanted to be a politician, but I really did want to do criminal justice. So unlike a more generalist politician who has to know everything about an entire city, I have deep expertise in the area where I am. And oh yes, I have tried plenty of felony cases and plenty of homicide cases. So I really feel like I have something to offer. We have had tremendous success when you look at the long, you know, the long term, when you look at the reality that we have not just seen, as Dugan says, declines in crime and during the Parker administration. These declines are going back and they're consistent all the way to the bad days of the pandemic. It's been year after year of declining crime, year after year of declining violent crime, year after year of declining numbers of people in custody for no good reason.
No, after a steep rise before that, right? And what is your explanation for the rise?
It's called the pandemic. I mean, I think everybody, nobody even disputes this anymore. It swept the entire country. It swept Philadelphia as well. But we have seen this going on for years.
Now, the decline is across the country as well, too.
I agree with that. And if you look more closely at the data, you'll see that in 2024, we were basically leading the country in terms of cities of a million or more, which is remarkable because we're also one of the poorest, and we're also in a state that has stupid lack of gun regulation, right? Very hard thing to do. But we were leading the country. I mean, it's really something this year to be looking at beating the lowest number of homicides in the last 50 years when there are literally more guns on the street every day and we haven't actually fixed poverty. We have done better than other major cities. And yes, you're absolutely right that these are all the result of multiple factors. They're all the result of national factors, too.
Yeah, I got to ask you to lay out your vision for a third term. Like, what do you see as being your top three priorities going, if you're reelected? What would be your top three priorities?
Well, simply put, safety is the number one priority, and we've made tremendous progress in that. We need to continue to do it. There are certain specific things we can do to further that. One of them is to actually build that forensics lab that I've been talking about for nearly 8 years that the mayor, and I must give credit to her for this, has budgeted some money for. This should not take 5 years to get done. If we had a state-of-the-art forensics lab that had the bandwidth to do everything that can be done now, I'm telling you right now, we'd drop our crime another 10%. And that's a lot. We could do that. This should have been done 10 years ago. It should have been done actually 15 or 20 years ago. But if we would do that, it would help us to continue to improve public safety. The other thing, of course, is freedom. You know, we have had real good success with safety in terms of investment in prevention. That has been citywide. It's been city council. It's been the mayor. It's been really good. But part of the reason we have the money to do that is because we have more freedom. When you're actually separating the wheat from the chaff, the people who need to be in jail from the ones who never really needed to be in jail, they needed something else. When you actually separate them out, when you go from nearly 10,000 people in county custody under Lynn Abraham, and you're down now at about 3,300, 3,400, you're doing that at the same time as you're setting historic records for safety, I'll take more safety, and I'll take more freedom, and I'll take them all at the same time.
There are people who disagree with you over your policies, maybe your ideology. There are other people, though, I think, who disagree, who oppose you perhaps because they think that there's too much ego, that it's about you're inflexible, and that if an idea is not your idea, then it can't be a good idea. And this was brought up in the case of like Dawn Court and Veterans Court. Do you believe there are good ideas that you have rejected because they were in place before you got there? And can you point to good ideas that existed before you got there that you have actually nurtured and, you know, carried through?
Well, once again, my opponent doesn't let the facts get in the way. Not only have we supported Veterans Court, which has been his baby until he quit, not only do we support it, we think it should be expanded. I actually made efforts to get the feds to do a Veterans Court back when they didn't have one. I've never said I am opposed to that. So if I agree with him, does that still make me somebody who disagrees with everyone? I mean, that's just nonsense. Dawn Court had some very fundamental problems. Those problems remain. It was discriminatory in various different ways. It was very ineffective. The public defenders wouldn't put their clients who were charged with sex work into it. And it also comes from the flawed premise, and it's a deeply flawed premise, that the way you help people is to put handcuffs on them first. There are public health approaches to help sex workers that are readily available to the city. And the city can work on them, and I am ready to partner with them anytime. But I'm not about making victims into criminals because they're suffering from rape trauma, because they're suffering from mental health issues, because they're self-medicating with and addicted to drugs. I'm not going to do that. That is a stupid old approach that we should never replicate. We should be helping people without handcuffs when that can work.
Yeah. And I want to go back to the wellness court because we are about to wrap up. But if you were to fix this, because people have criticized this wellness court, and I get it, it's a city thing. But if you were to implement a fix, if you were in charge of that, like what do you think would make it more efficient and allow more people to flow through that?
Well, you know, there are many, many different issues, but I think one of the key ones is there's a lot of sort of vague talk about how much is available in terms of treatment. And it talks about a number of beds, but it doesn't differentiate the reality that the beds needed for people in acute addiction are a much smaller number. We have a situation right now where when people are detoxing, they're not detoxing from heroin. They're not detoxing from heroin mixed with fentanyl. They're detoxing from what might not be heroin at all anymore, and a whole combination of horrific drugs, some of which we can hardly even diagnose. Even in an intensive care unit, people detoxing have the potential of dying because of what they've taken in, even with medical professionals at their bedside. Okay? That's not just a bed somewhere. That is an intensive care type bed. And the number of them available is actually quite small compared to the number of beds. So, you know, this is why there just need to be more people in the conversation. There are doctors, there are PhDs who spent their whole careers on this stuff, who could really assist and help to guide it. You know, it's, look, I could not be more dedicated to the idea of helping people who are in addiction, helping people who are unhoused. We just have to do it the right way and with all the right people in the room. I have been ready from the beginning to be one of them.
That is the final word for District Attorney Larry Krasner, running for his third term. The November election is coming up in a little less than a week. D.A. Krasner, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producers, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY here in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you next week.